is co-discovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Core Discovery podcast with me, Abigail Acton. Shuttered windows, closed shopping centres. Our high streets are feeling the brunt of the coronavirus crisis. Businesses which relied entirely on their bricks and mortar presence have had to scramble to get their shops online or face a total collapse of income, holding out if they can for a footfall to return to our streets. Food sellers have been faced with the logistical challenge of getting perishable goods out to customers, unable or unwilling to come to supermarkets for the weekly shop. All this pressure on a sector that has already had to rethink its model in the face of competition from online giants and a pre-pandemic drift to e-commerce. Is retail just one other industry facing a fundamental shift to the way it will operate in a post-COVID world? Will people flock back to the shops? Some have saved money during the crisis, those able to work from home but not able to spend on holidays, events or leisure. How will our shops entice them in? In an increasingly cashless society, does our dependence on paying by card make us vulnerable to fraud? Buying at a distance means returning more goods. How can the economic and environmental impact of that be mitigated? Perhaps our three guests, whose work was supported by the EU's Horizon 2020 programme, have some answers. A warm welcome to Frank Sandilov, CEO of Card Lab Innovation, who has been an electronic warfare officer in the Danish Army, an airline captain, and a biometric expert for the International Air Transport Association. Frank has a keen interest in cybersecurity, fraud prevention, and unique biometric user identification with a focus on privacy protection. He was the coordinator of the QuadCard project. Hello, Frank.
Hello. Thanks for having me here.
Daphne Pineapple, a B2B marketeer at Bybay, a business that combats the waste in e-commerce by processing and reselling returned products and overstock, is interested in everything related to retail and sustainability. She is responsible for marketing with a focus on business development and process optimization. Daphne was involved in the Smile project. Hello, Daphne. Welcome.
Hi, Abigail.
Dr. Mary Ellen Foster is a senior lecturer in human-robot interaction at the University of Glasgow. Her research is in the area of social robotics, developing robots that are enabled to engage in face-to-face conversation with human partners, and then exploring how people react to those robots in a range of public spaces. Mary Ellen was the coordinator of the Mama Project. Good morning, Mary Ellen.
Hi, it's nice to talk to you today.
Very welcome, all of you. The Abel Prize, which honours achievements in mathematics, has just been awarded to Israeli Avi Wigerson and Hungarian Laszlo Lovas for their contributions to computer security. Security and its connection to digital activity is clearly under the spotlight. Certainly current trends make the work done by the QuadCard project more relevant than ever. So Frank, if I can turn to you first. For the past year, online retail has seen a real boom, and those shopping in supermarkets and other essential stores have turned to cashless payments. Do these shifts leave people more exposed to fraud?
Unfortunately, the story tells, yes, that is the truth. What we see now is that the criminal activities, they follow the money. And today, the money are digital and they are in data. That's where you got the real value. So we see a cybersecurity concern from our side that needs to be mitigated. We see a rise in identity theft, and that means you can lose your personal data, but also your financial data. We see hacking of e-commerce sites, which again exposes both the merchants and also the user. And we also see chargeback fraud is on the rise. And one thing is that hackers are really active today. By the way, you could buy into the ATAR lottery. You can buy up to 10,000 Indian users. And probably there's some in between. You've got active data that has value. That's one. And then we see passwords, because you have today a number of passwords, an average of 40, 45 you have to remember. That means we are becoming lazy. We have to remember the same words. We put the same in the same place. And that means hacking your computers. If you hack one site, you will get access to a lot of stuff. So yes, people are absolutely becoming more vulnerable, and that's what we need to look at.
And how has QuadCard been trying to make shopping and the use of credit cards safer?
What we have done is create the biometric payment card, but it also is a card that works for a lot of other stuff. But that gives you the ability to control your own data. It stays in the card, you control it by your fingerprint, enables you to have a higher payment limit, it gives you privacy protection. It also gives you 100% certainty that you are the one you claim to be. And that works the other way around. You as a merchant would also like to know who you're dealing with.
Can I stop you for a second? I'm curious. So you say it reads fingerprints, but if you're buying online, talk me through it. I go to somewhere, I decide to buy online. How would I use your card?
What we do on the online event is that we have the card, we have a back-end authentication solution. So when you identify yourself on the card turns you into a token where you can use online. That means your true identity is not visible to man in the middle or anybody else on the internet, except for those who need to know who you are. And that gives you a lot more certainty that we can eliminate online fraud, which is today is a big hassle.
Okay, so each time you use the card, you become a different identity almost because of the token that represents who you are changes with each of your interactions.
Yeah, and if somebody tries to use your token, it's already been used, you will be rejected.
Right, it's expired because it's one time only.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. So if I was in a retail environment, bricks and mortar, when we do eventually go back into our shops, as I'm sure we will, how does it work then?
That works exactly in the same way because we can do the same level of security. The token will pass via the point of sale, or you can do it in, yeah. The first step is that you identify yourself biometrically. That can be done, let's say, on the first level of security. The second level, maximum security, is tokenizing your identity. And then we use it with a new PSD2 where you authorize what it is that you're doing online.
Sorry, what is a PSD2 that you just mentioned?
The PSD2 is a payment service directive issued by the EU, two and a half years ago,
uh-huh.
Where you actually verify your payment. Today, you also online receive an SMS. You have to verify who you are. With a biometric card, you can get rid of all that hassle waiting for the SMS and make sure you're online, etc. You do everything on the card, and as it's offline, there's nobody else being able to look at what you're doing. So the hackers have been excluded from your environment.
Perfect, like a bubble, like a protective bubble.
Exactly. And if you cannot see it, you cannot hack it.
Right, right. Perfect. And are credit cards interested? Because this sounds a little bit like disruptive technology, the notion of having to have a way of reading the fingerprint that's integrated into the card itself. Are credit card companies interested in taking up this idea?
Yes. We actually got accepted by the MasterCard Lighthouse program. They wanted to get us on because they're working on cryptos. They're working on, let's say, the future of payment. They're working on smart city solutions as well. And what they also know is the cybersecurity is a major part, a major problem that needs to be solved here. So we're in this program together with potentially a number of partners, and we also have other companies, fintech companies around the world looking into our solutions, cryptocurrencies, etc. So there's a huge interest in it.
So it might be possible that we would be carrying one of these cards in our wallet at some point in the near future or mid future or long term, more or less?
I'd say the mid future.
Okay.
That would be a ramp up process, of course.
Yes.
And that'll be the legislation that needs to be in place today. You've got central databases and so on. People need to know how vulnerable they are before they really start to invest in secure solutions.
Yes, and unfortunately, we find out how vulnerable we are often when it's too late, shutting stable doors after horses have bolted, etc. Yeah.
Yeah, we consider biometric card is more or less like buying an insurance.
Right, indeed. Very interesting. Thank you. Marielle and Daphne, would you have any questions that you would like to put to Frank?
I mean, I guess I'm just curious. I'm trying to imagine what this would physically look like. Does it look basically like a credit card that you would actually hold? It would fit in your wallet the same way a normal one would?
Exactly. It's got the same dimensions as a credit card, but it has a fingerprint sensor on, it has a display, and has a lot of electronics inside. So just try to imagine a McDonald's being pressed together to a 0.7 of a millimeter thickness. So it is normal credit card shape, and it works in the existing infrastructure, works with whatever exists today.
Fantastic. That sounds excellent. And another thing, of course, is the fact that we need to encourage people to return to retail bricks and mortar and any way that facilitates their payment systems. And of course, we've become cashless with the pressure of the coronavirus crisis. So that also would be another use that I can see being very popular. Mary Ellen, if I could turn to you, talking about trying to entice shoppers back. Online, of course, has taken off and exploded, but how do you think we are going to be able to get people back into shops once they can actually go? How is your robotics background and ideas helping with that, do you think?
Yeah, so what we did on the project that I coordinated was we took a humanoid robot and we put it into a shopping mall, basically beside the information desk. So there are people at the information desk who will tell you how to find the food court and where the toilets are and what the specials are today. And we figured that was kind of, for our initial deployment anyway, here's a good use case for this robot to put it there. And it did attract a lot of people's attention that there was a robot that they could talk to. And I think, I mean, a big difference between, I mean, one difference, and Daphne's probably going to talk about this, with bricks and mortar versus online shopping, is can you actually see and touch and feel the goods before you actually buy them? But another thing is just the whole sort of overall experience of being in a place, maybe, you know, because we've shown you can do shopping without having to go anywhere. So there has to be some other reason to go to these places.
Some sort of added value.
Yes. Yeah. And it, you could sort of see robots like what we tried putting in there as kind of an added value. You go to the shop, you do all of your shopping things, but you can also maybe have a conversation with a robot while you're there.
Which is always cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. The what people, you've probably seen these robots in shops before. What tends to happen with them quite a lot of the time is they do attract attention. And people are like, wow, cool, a robot. And then it turns into essentially a kiosk. Once you've actually come up to the robot, it attracts people's attention, but then it essentially devolves into you're using it as a touchscreen, or it does nothing. So what we did in Mummer was try to take that use case, take that people's interest in a robot, but try to make it actually able to have a conversation with, because people want to have a conversation with these robots. But if the robot's not able to reply, then people will say, fine, okay, I'll just use a touchscreen. So we tried to make it able to engage in a bit of social conversation if people want to, as well as sort of directing them to the coffee shop. So that was the goal of what we were trying to do in this project.
Did you manage to move away from gimmick to useful tool? I mentioned that because I came across a robot once in a hotel reception. I think it was Amsterdam, and it was intriguing. But all it could really do was tell me what the prospective weather forecast was, which I had multiple ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a bit hard to come up with a use case this was a use case where people do come to the information desk and ask for information. So we thought this is, when we talked to we did some co-design work with the shop owners and the mall owners at the start of this project, and they sort of brainstormed all the things they thought the robot could do. Things like carry your packages for you, things like provide security. Like, no, the robot we're using can't do these things. What this robot can do is talk and gesture. And so on. So we try to think of a use case that would actually be useful. And because of the challenges of doing this actually in a wide open space, the conversation did actually kind of end up being, please tell me where the food court is. Oh, it's over there. But in sort of a bit more, we did some lab-based testing as well. And it was able, if you wanted to chat about the weather or chat about movies, if you had a bit, if you were in the mall and you wanted to spend a bit of time talking to somebody, it was capable of that. Not so much during the actual deployment in the mall for various technical reasons, but it is a use case that we think, if you could get a bit more of, people want to talk to a robot. People are really excited about a robot. The first time it kind of fails, then they're like, okay, fine, whatever, I'll stop trying. So we want to avoid that moment of, we want to sort of get it so that it can have a social conversation with people in that sort of context.
Yeah, no, absolutely fascinating. And of course, it's it's an initial foot in the water to see public engagement with the device as well. And so what was the feedback from the general public? Did they embrace it? What did you find out?
Yeah, I mean, people would talk to it, but I think we weren't able to detect, for various privacy reasons, whether people were coming back to it repeatedly. So we have a whole lot of one-off interactions. And people found it neat. People found it interesting. It attracted attention. I'm not sure that the interactions were quite what we'd hoped, also because the shopping mall where we put this was in Finland. So the robot had to speak in Finnish, which was a whole extra level of language processing challenge. If we'd had it in an English-speaking, unfortunately, this is the reality of natural language processing right now. If we'd had it in an English-speaking place, the speech recognition would probably have been better. So that added an additional challenge. But still, people were positive about it. People enjoyed it. People found it neat. It just didn't do such a good job of understanding them. So maybe it wasn't quite as useful as we'd hoped, but it was still a good proof of concept that we'd like to try to build on.
Sure. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, these things they develop over steps and stages. And so you've established that it has something to offer and that people want to engage in it. I mean, if I see a robot, I want to engage with it. Absolutely. Yeah. What are your next steps? Do you have plans to build on this?
Well, the project is finished now. Certainly in Glasgow, my particular research team, I've got a PhD student who's working right now to try to figure out how we could adapt this robot to be deployed in a museum on campus at the University of Glasgow. So then we tried to think about, and there's sort of Glasgow specific issues to do with how do people want to interact. And accents and things like that in Glasgow. So we're trying to take this use case and try to deploy it in other public spaces and other contexts and sort of see how do people respond to it and how should the behavior maybe change for different deployment locations.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating.
I know other project members are also trying to explore deploying bits of the system in other contexts, but in Glasgow, that's our specific goal, is to try to deploy it around Glasgow.
Oh, fascinating. I'm tempted to go and check it out when we can finally travel again. Absolutely. Do either of you, Frank and Daphne, have a question for Mary Ellen? Frank, maybe something about the security focus.
Yeah, just very short, because I know there's a lot of work going into doing a job like this, and we all seen some of those movies where the soldiers are going around, some have been reprogrammed by the wrong people. So Mary Ellen, I was just wondering, what are you doing in terms of protection? Because you're actually working on an IoT device.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say the security is not something we've thought about much up to this point in this space, because it was more a matter of getting it working at all. But yes, this is an internet-connected piece of hardware that's sitting out in public on a public Wi-Fi network. So yes, these are things we need to think about, because obviously there's issues now in kind of conversational systems in terms of systems learning to, you know, either learning to say bad things or behaving in bad ways. And even if we manage to program them so that they don't do those things, if there's somebody who kind of gets in as a, you know, gives us new language models so it'll behave in different ways. So putting robots in public spaces, that's not something we've thought about much yet, but it's definitely a thing we need to start thinking about if we want to put these things out in the world more. So it's a good point.
Yeah, indeed. Daphne, would you have any questions for Mary Ellen or for Frank?
Yeah, I was wondering, could it also replace personnel in shops? Like instead of an employee that helps you with checking the clothes or the products, that a robot could do?
Yes, for sure, yes. It would need to be a slightly different robot platform that was able to maybe grasp things. Our robot wasn't very good at holding on to things, so we couldn't actually physically manipulate objects very well. But yeah, you could imagine, I can't imagine it being the only employee in a shop, but it could work alongside the staff. A lot of times what people end up using robots for are things that are kind of repetitive, things that have to be done, but then that frees up the staff to do the sort of more creative, interesting things where human intelligence is really required. So I wouldn't see it replacing shop assistants, but I could see it working alongside shop assistants in probably a useful way.
I mean, anyone who's been shoe shopping.
Yeah.
When you see the poor people finding you the shoe, and then in fact it's the wrong size, they go to the storehouse, they come back and so on, the warehouse or whatever, and they come back and so on, and they're doing that multiple times a day for multiple customers at the same time. I could imagine that would be quite useful to have something you could just send to go get the shoes. Yeah. Daphne, that's the notion of bricks and mortar and getting people into shops, which perhaps is going to be a challenge in itself after the COVID crisis passes and ebbs, all of us having gotten so used to buying online. But buying online brings about its own problems as well, not being able to touch things, try them on, the returns are shooting through the roof. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening with people returning products because they can't try them and see them in physically before buying?
Yes, of course. So what we've seen is that the crisis has permanently changed consumer shopping behavior. It has brought a large group of people online who were not online shopping before. So the question for retailers is not whether they should use e-commerce, but how they will do so. And with online shopping come the returns because people can't try them on or can't feel the product. So the University of Bamberg investigated if customer order and return behavior grew or changed during the pandemic. And what we saw is that the overall online order grew, and not surprisingly, the total amount of number of returns grew accordingly. However, we see a slight decrease in the returns percentage, which makes sense if you think about it, because in COVID-19 times, customers order actual needs like groceries or care products or equipment that you need for your home office. So whether a customer returns is heavily dependent on the product category. But indeed, overall, we see with growing e-commerce, grow the returns. But there are ways to reduce them in the first place. So what we see is when companies give more detailed product information or instruction videos, they can reduce returns. But of course, e-tailers and retailers do receive them. And it's our question, or the question that we address, is how to handle them. And some of the old-fashioned options For e-tailers and retailers, we're selling them to bulk buyers for not even 10% of the value, or offering them a second hand on their own web shop, or destroying them because they think, okay, those products, they don't have any value anymore. And that happens a lot to low value products. So the retail sector is impacted like huge, and companies are experiencing a huge loss of values.
And exactly at a time when, of course, they're being hit so hard by the current situation anyway. So it's really lose-lose in this situation. So they're forced to sell more online, and then they're forced to deal with more stuff bouncing back to them. So your project was the Smile Project, and you were working towards trying to mitigate the impact, the environmental impact, and also, you know, the cost to businesses. So what did the Smile Project set out to do to try and alleviate this?
Yeah, well, we've received almost 2 million euros under the Smile Project, which is great. And we've devoted it into improving our data model and renewing our software because we are a software company, and our expansion outside of the Benelux.
So what do you actually offer to retailers then, if they take up the possibility of your concepts? What how does it work for them?
Yeah, well, if a customer returns their food processor or wastebasket, our software takes over the intake and sale completely. And it can be done in our own warehouse or as the software as a service at our partner's warehouse. But that software knows exactly what is wrong with the product and how popular that specific product is in the market. So we inspect each product, we investigate the product, we evaluate the quality. So how good is it, or are there any accessories missing or something? So we register the shortcomings and the features, and then we clean it. So we can make sure it goes on stock again. And from day to day, our software calculates the most optimal selling price on the best site possible, which could be an online marketplace or an auction platform. And in this way, we can sell every product at an optimal price and to a new customer who enjoys a just as good product for a discount.
Right. And so the retailer, of course, then gets money back from something that otherwise they might, in the worst case scenario, have sent to landfill.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. And are retailers showing an interest in participating in this concept and using your software?
Yes. Yes. Or our full service model, because there are sort of two ways. Some retailers have their own warehouse and their own grading, we call it. So the inspection of the products. Some have them in-house, but there are also a lot of retailers and e-tailers that do not have such a department themselves. So then we take over the whole process completely.
Mm-hmm. And they're showing interest. And you're trying to expand it further? Is there uptake outside your country?
Yes, we're now, we have expanded to Germany last year, and it's going quite well. And with the software as a service, we can serve more companies within Europe, and we can make the software super standardized so that it works for all kinds of products. Because I think that's one of our unique selling points is that, or one of our benefits is that we can handle all kinds of products.
Right. That's really very interesting. And it's, I think, reassuring to know that somehow the waste is being cut down and reduced, because I know myself that I've sent back more than I'm comfortable having sent back. You know, if you're between sizes, it's always a little bit of a lottery. Yeah?
It's such a waste. And we also see that companies say to their customer, please keep it. I know you want to return it, but it costs us more to process the product. So please keep it. And what we do is we create waste because customers are like, they are not using their product. And it's such a waste because another customer can be super happy with it.
Very true. Very true. Mary Ellen, Frank, would you have any questions to Daphne?
Just a quick one, because I'm the kind of people you hate, I guess, because I hate going on the internet and doing the trade, because always, not always, but quite often I have to return it. I really hate that process. So I was looking in your system. It looks like you also got some artificial intelligence to help companies build up a better understanding of what they need to inform so we can make better choices when we go on the internet. Could you say a little more about this?
Yeah, well, our field of expertise lies more in the, okay, when we have returns, how can we handle them and how can we give them a second life? So avoiding the returns, we do help customers with their product information. So giving a lot of content for the customers. But our expertise is more in the, okay, when we have returns, how can we handle them? And how can we make sure that those returned goods are optimized and are sold again? And we also use pictures for that. So during the whole process, we make photographs of the whole product with all the features. So customers can reach out to us and ask for the pictures before they even buy it so that they know, okay, what's wrong with that product. And in this way, we make sure that the customers are fully aware of what they're buying and do not return that specific product again.
So it's basically management of expectation, so you know what you're going to get. Very interesting. Well, I think that the insights that you've all provided us into how the EU is supporting work that is trying to ensure that the retail sector thrives, both during the situation and afterwards, is very significant. And I really hope that all of your ideas are going to be available and make it. Can I just ask you one question as a final question to wind down? And that would be, individually now, first I'll start with Mary Ellen. What shift do you think that the retail sector will witness in the coming decade?
Well, I think more and more of this sort of delegating some of the repetitive tasks to robots, not just kind of in the back, you know, there's obviously robots in warehouses now, but having sort of socially intelligent robots kind of front of house, as we did it at the information kiosk, as Daphne suggested, actually in the shop. I think trying to sort of have some sort of combination of automated, you know, not beyond just sort of self-scans, but sort of more intelligent things you can actually have a conversation with, maybe get advice or something on what to buy. I think having that sort of automation in the shops more and more with my lens on, that's what I would sort of imagine.
Yeah, and it's your lens that I'm inviting. So that's excellent. Thank you. And Frank, over the next decade, what do you think we will witness?
I agree that we'll see automation to a large extent, I think. I also believe that we'll be looking into better authentication of both the buyer and the seller. So the biometrics is going to come some way or the other. And that's going to be some of the big themes. And then we'll see probably a more hand-in-hand physical retail experience together with the digital experience, because we will need still to go back into the shops, do some testing, see how the clothes works on us and test new things. Because what I've experienced at least is when we can't meet the customers, we're not able to tell people what's really new in the market and what's the new we can provide to them.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And Daphne, what do you think is going to happen in the coming decade?
Well, retail is going to be more focused on online. So what we just talked about with returns growing, but also with the importance of informing your customers, it will be a very important thing for retailers to keep in mind. And that if they receive returns, because I don't think that will ever stop with online shopping, that they can have a solution that's beneficial for them, but also for the environment. And maybe the latter is even more important, as we have to go to a circular society in which we optimally reuse materials and products. So it's getting even more significant over the coming years.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Well, thank you all very much for having spent some time with me this morning and sharing your ideas, which have been very interesting. I'm grateful to you all for having taken part.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure being on board.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was great.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Find out what other projects are working on to help the EU's retail sector to thrive by taking a look at the Research EU magazine, New Synergies of Shopping, E-commerce or Bricks and Mortar, available on the Cordis website, cordis.europa.eu. Curious to see what else is being achieved thanks to EU science funding? The Cordis website offers you short news stories, interviews with researchers who are exploring everything from the domestication of early canines to wormholes, results packs bringing a variety of projects together. If you have a special interest, take a look. We've probably covered it. To help you drill down into the research in a particular field, the magazine, available online or in print, has a special section which the Core Discovery podcast explores. And if you think you have a project that could benefit from EU support, come and check out what others are doing in your field. Take a look at the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. Our next episode will consider transforming European health systems in the wake of COVID-19. What can our scientific community do to meet the challenges that lie ahead? Join me to hear what three leading researchers in the field can reveal. We're always happy to hear from you, so drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.